Bob Grant used to say in New York. I've noticed that coming over the wires here, yesterday I got a little news alert about this. That is that the Hillel, the Tufts Hillel, is now an open Hillel. It's part of the open Hillel movement. It says here in the Jewish Advocate, as students at Tufts University here were participating in a commencement exercise May 21st, a major announcement sent shockwaves through the campus Jewish community. In a post on its Facebook page, Tufts Hillel declared itself an open Hillel. Now, I want to talk about what that means. But before I do, I want to mention that Tufts University has been involved in anti-Israel activities before. This isn't the first time. We know that during the Passover holiday, when the Tufts University Jewish students were away, the state got this, the council, the student government, behind closed doors and in secret and without mentioning names, voted to boycott the state of Israel. Now, this was done the same within a day or two of an attack on a Coptic Christian church in Egypt, where basically radical Islamic terrorists essentially, you know, locked the place down, went in and just blew the place up, killing everyone in there. We're talking about 30, 35 people, men, women, and children. And it also coincided with an attack by an Islamic extremist who yelled, "God is the greatest," while he stabbed a police officer to death in London and slashed several people on the London Bridge. And yet the student government here at Tufts decided that the best approach was to boycott the state of Israel. So it created somewhat of a not to mention a stir, but an outrage among the Jewish community around the country. It made national news. And that even included left-wing Jews. I mean, even they were a little uncomfortable. They even have a conscience to the degree that the left has any. You know, they have a few scruples banging around in their souls, you know, even though they've imbibed, you know, the authoritarian faith for a long time. And even they were outraged by the obvious and blatant Jew-hating anti-Semitism that was involved in that. That was followed by a visit from the head of the Anti-Defamation League, who also happens to be a Tufts University graduate, that being his name is Ron Greenblatt, I believe, who was previously scheduled to deliver a speech and did so, and at the time asked that this be rescinded. It was, or at least it was condemned by the Tufts University administration, much to their credit. And I don't know if that is still on the books, but the issue was somewhat abated by the fact that the administration had the moral courage to come out and condemn it. Yet now this is another little wrinkle in the ongoing saga at Tufts University, in that the Hillel has now declared itself a, quote, open Hillel. Now, I want to talk a little bit about what open Hillel is. It was a movement that was started actually at Harvard a couple of years ago. And what it was an attempt by ultra-leftist Jews to want to, and maybe non-Jews, I'm not sure, I could, you know, look into that, this just came to me, but they wanted to make sure that the Palestinian side was articulated in Hillel. Now, the Palestinian side has plenty of opportunities to be articulated in any other venue. I mean, they've got the Palestinian club here. So why would they have to be articulated in an organization, that being Hillel, which by its own charter, by its own purpose, and one of its most basic flanks is support for the state of Israel. Why can't a pro-Israel organization simply exist in the same way that you'd have a pro-anything else organization? You know, you've got Black Lives Matter. You've got, abortion groups, you know, and for NARAL, you know, who would an abortion group, for example, a group that favors abortion, should they be required to have, pro-life people in it? I don't think so. I think that there's plenty of places, there's plenty of space for diversity in the real sense, in that people who hold a particular political opinion or social opinion ought to have the right to establish an organization to get together with like-minded people. Now, I don't think, therefore, that you need a white supremacy group. That's another matter. You know, I mean, being pro-Israel doesn't mean that you're anti-non-Israel. Doesn't mean that you're anti-Arab, for sure. You know, it doesn't exist because it's against something else. It's not claiming that Israel is superior. It's simply a position that they support the sovereignty of the state of Israel. And they want to have an organization where people of like mind can get together in a safe atmosphere and develop and articulate that position on the, in this case, the campus of Tufts University. Why should they have to welcome in people who are anti-Israel? I mean, really, let's think about that. You know, I mean, is that really right? So this is a it's an interesting development. I mean, this is another small step for the left to infiltrate and eventually take over an organization. And they do it under the name of, quote unquote, diversity. We have to have a diversity of opinion. You know, they want to have, first of all, they go on a long litany of people that they want to have a diversity of opinion for. And that, of course, includes transgender because that's the latest. But there's others. The fact is that all of those, you know, groups can be in Hillel as long as they're pro-Israel. You know, there's certainly, I'm sure, transgendered Israelis or transgendered people on campuses that are pro-Israel. You know, this isn't about excluding anybody. You know, it's simply saying that we have a particular political position. I mean, should a Democratic Party group be required to have somebody like me who is a supporter of President Trump? I don't think so. They have a right to have a group that hates Trump. I respect that. I'd like to debate them. If the anti-Israel crowd wants to debate Hillel, let them do so. Let them ask for a debate. Let's have it. You know, let's have at it. But why should they have the right under the quote, the rubrics of diversity to infiltrate and thus subvert and weaken Hillel by allowing anti-Israel people to have a place at the table? I mean, that's a question that I suppose I'm going to have to let linger out there in the minds of you, my millions of listeners. And ask yourself, do you want to have the right to associate with groups that include like-minded people on any issue? Or should you be forced to be in a group where there are people who don't agree with your position so that there could be a council meeting about it? I mean, is there something wrong with associating? I mean, look, a religion by nature is a group of people that accept certain beliefs. You know, if you're Christian, I assume that you are joining a Christian church because you believe that Jesus was the Christ, right? And that he's your personal Lord and Savior who died for your sins and all of the rest. Should that religion be forced to have people who are into the Antichrist or who are anti-religion or who are atheist openly? I mean, we all, you know, atheism is fine, but if you're openly advocating for a no belief in Christ, a no belief in God, you know, you get to form your own group. That's part of being in a free country. You know, if you want to have an anti-religious group, there's plenty of them. Go ahead, you know, join them and form them. But why should you have the right to be a member of a group that has the opposite opinion? It just doesn't make sense. You know, I mean, it basically undermines the entire edifice of the right to free speech and the right to opinion and to express that opinion in an organized manner by working with others who share that opinion. So this, you know, this Open Hillel, this is nothing more than a left-wing vanguard trying to infiltrate Hillel and destroy it from within, in my opinion. They want to subvert it. They want to undermine its belief in the state of Israel as the right to exist as a sovereign Jewish state. And they want to, you know, cloud that up and muddy up those waters. They know that they can't do an open assault because that will be rebuffed. So they're worming their way in like termites. You know, they're going to eat away at the foundation until one day the Hillel group will wake up and find it that the whole castle has collapsed on its own rot. So I am dismayed, to put it mildly, at the existence of this anti-Israel development. And I utterly reject this principle, which, of course, is a communist principle, that everybody has to be de facto equal and that every opinion has to be equal. And you may note that the people who are the fastest and the quickest to advocate this are the least tolerant when it comes to genuine opposition. I can speak to that, and I can tell you that. I can tell you stories of what's happened to me in various situations where I've dealt with people on the far left. They cannot hear anything I have to say. If I speak, they have to shut me down. They can only hear a little bit of it. You know, it's kind of amusing watching as the presidency of Donald Trump unfolds, watching leftist friends of mine and members of my family, you know, people who are junkies when it comes to news and politics, watching TV now with Trump as president, and you get the usual diet of hate emanating from the leftist media, what President Trump quite accurately and brilliantly calls the fake media. And so they're listening to this, and the minute somebody says something even remotely positive about Trump, they automatically will switch the station. They cannot stand it. You know, I had this one woman who is a member of my family, very left-wing, let me know very, very bluntly, I cannot watch media anymore. So I'm watching reruns of, I think it was West Wing or some TV show. I cannot bear it. And what do I think of that? And my response is that, first of all, as a media person myself, someone who hosts a radio show, someone who writes a column, someone who is authoring books and a podcast, I like to expose myself to all points of view. I listen both to left and right radio. I read both left and right columns just about every day. I mean, I keep an eye on it. You know, I get Breitbart, which is brilliant, their media serve. But I also get Alternet and Counterpunch and Nation and all the left-wing ones, too. And I want to know what they're thinking. I want to know what all sides think on an issue, and I'm open to ideas and opinions. To that extent, I think that my approach actually is a pretty accurate reflection of most conservatives who approach it this way. So, you know, the left is much more authoritarian. They cannot have opposition opinion. It shakes their hard cage a little too much. You know, they have to exist in this this kind of false universe, basically, that, you know, that cannot be. It's a cult. It's an ideology. Whereas conservatism is not. Conservatism, then there are exceptions. It tends to be, you know, something that is a reflection of the real world. You know, it's a reflection of reality. It's a reflection of what, you know, a quest for truths. So as such, you'd find that conservatives generally are looking for truths as opposed to feeding some sort of, you know, hard-bound ideological position. You know, generally conservatives don't need to do that because they're confident in their own position. Anyway, so I've written my latest article for Newsmax, "By Exposing Media, Trump Might Make It More Honest." This is posted on my blog site, of course. You can check it out at Chuck Morse Speaks. I'm going to read a little bit of this. Media mandarins are whining about how President Trump's tweets are an attack on the media, but they miss the point. President Trump's tweets are the media. My tweets are the media. All our tweets are the media. We can all now open a Twitter account for free and build our own media empire with our own network of friends and followers. President Trump has a Twitter following of over 30 million, which means that he can directly reach 10 times the number of people during a day than do most cable TV shows or newspapers. Now, let me just... I got the idea of writing this, and I'll read on, but I want to comment a bit. From listening to the fake news reaction to President Trump's latest tweets and his calling out CNN and all of that, where you have two very prominent leftist reporters, Eric Lichtblau and David Franks, both of whom have authored books that are way out there, both of whom I have interviewed in the past. They were fired. I would say they were, you know, they resigned under a cloud, let's put it that way, from CNN because they had gone with a story that turned out to be false and falsely accused someone of this whole phony Russia-Trump conspiracy the left has concocted, you know, saying this guy was doing business with the Russians and he also is a friend of Trump, blah, blah, blah. It turned out to be untrue. So they had to resign. And the reaction by the left media, the fake media, at CNN itself, of course, but also at MSNBC and, you know, progressive radio. I listen to all these things. They're all suddenly screeching about President Trump threatening the media, threatening free speech, right? By President Trump calling them out on Twitter. I mean, they're absolutely in a state of apoplexy over this. They're, you know, it's almost comical. And so I was thinking about that, and I've realized that the fact is that they, you know, we all know that it's fake media. I think it's obvious that they've been in the tank for the left for probably the last many, many decades, and that it used to be worse. And I point this out in my article. I'll get to that. But that they do slant the news toward the left. The New York Times is on the left. I don't think there's any question about that. And it's not so much what the New York Times reports, it's what they don't report that makes them on the left. They will edit the news. If you only read the New York Times, you get a very narrow, very leftist view of what's going on in the world, because that reflects the values and the opinions of the people at the New York Times, but it also reflects an agenda of the New York Times. Let's not forget the New York Times soft-pedaled Soviet communism going all the way back to the days of Lenin, And it's soft-pedaled Nazism, I may add. You know, they love authoritarian, leftist, socialistic experiments. And they very rarely let in a little wrinkle of conservative opinion or conservative news. And when they do, they bury it into their, you know, into the page. So the fact that President Trump is now using Twitter to call them out is something they just don't know how to get a handle on. They don't know how to deal with it. And the fact that additionally, that President Donald Trump doesn't speak in this sort of phony British accent, you know, using euphemisms and sophistry and indirection. And, you know, like something I think of John Kerry as a good example of that. And even, you know, mainstream Republicans, you know, like George Bush Sr., maybe, you know, where they speak in syntax that's, you know, coded. It's difficult to understand. It sends out the message that we're smarter than everyone else, so you better listen to us. Or they do like Henry Kissinger used to do with a phony, you know, foreign accent. Oh, yes, you know. People sit back and they think, oh, wow, he really must be smart. Of course, we read in his biography that the whole thing was put on anyways. And he did it deliberately for two reasons. Because he wanted to sound smarter, because he wanted to pick up girls. But, you know, it's kind of this establishment tease that you come across. It's a means of communicating that French scholar Elaine Benescon referred to as the totalitarian language. It's almost their own language. They speak and Obama was a classic practitioner of this. Even recently, Obama gave a speech on the 4th of July where he said that Americans are too patriotic. It's not good. I mean, you know, but he said it in tones that were so, you know, intelligent sounding. And we always hear about how intelligent these people are. Trump doesn't do it. He never did do it. And it is the reason for his success. He speaks in a simple, direct, unrehearsed, plain American style. And that is driving them nuts. And his tweets are like that, too. They may be vulgar at times. I would prefer he doesn't get into the personal attacks. Although I understand why he is, and I don't blame him. I think he still needs to be a little bit more disciplined. But nevertheless, he speaks his mind. And he does so honestly and simply. And that's what drives them nuts, the honesty, actually. So, of course, they say, well, he lies. Hogwash, he doesn't lie. He's the most honest politician I've seen come down the pike since Honest Abe. I don't know. He's, you know, the kinds of lies that Trump does tell are the kinds of lies like, gee, you know, I caught a bigger fish than you, those sort of lies. And that's not good. You know, it doesn't reflect a good aspect of his character. But they're not the kind of lies like the establishment tells, usually in their indirect language, like, if you like your doctor, you could keep your doctor. If you like your health care plan, you could keep your health care plan. My health care plan is going to save you money. Those are big lies. Those are the kinds of outright lies that can hurt people. And that the left justifies those kinds of lies. As was said by the creator, by the way, of Obamacare, that being Jonathan Gruber of MIT, because they know that this will work on the American people. They have to use those to sell whatever they're pushing, and that they trust that the American people are stupid enough to believe this stuff, right? So then along comes Trump, who just simply speaks plain and tells it how it is, and it just is throwing out the whole thing out of whack. They can't get away with this stuff anymore. You can't get away with the... Well, first of all, if there's one thing that I think has happened since Trump was elected, and I think this is changing the history of this country, is that he has completely tossed on its ear political correctness, the inane, vicious attacks on people, with the claim that they've got something against someone because of their race, their ethnicity, their sexuality, their gender. Trump has thrown that out. He has thrown it out by saying, no, you know, I'm not going to bow to this sort of trivial attack because somebody says something that some authoritarian deems to be against somebody. And instead, I'm going to look at what policies actually do have something against race and ethnicity, and that those policies are leftist policies, which have hurt people, which have categorized people collectively based upon things like race and ethnicity. And then once they've been categorized, it hurts them. It creates a dialectic by which they can be used as cannon fodder in their demented idea of progress. I could get into details about that. This is something that was touched upon, frankly, by an article that was written about me in the Tufts Observer. And I'm happy to stand by it. I'm hoping maybe in the fall, once the college gets underway again, to have some of these professors at Tufts come up here and talk to me about this. And some of these, you know, there's now colleges that are offering degrees, for example, in social, what they call euphemistically social justice. Now, that's a euphemism for socialism. I want to ask them exactly what it is. How do they define social justice? And do they define it as I do? To my way of thinking, social justice is equal rights under the law, is private ownership of the means of production, is capitalism, and is belief in God and spirituality. That's social justice, not communism, not a redistribution of wealth, which makes everybody poor, and which restricts freedom, which is unnatural. Okay. So, how about President Trump's visit to Poland, which has been glorious, by the way, and which you have throngs of people chanting, Donald Trump, USA, Donald Trump, USA. You know, Trump has been embraced by the world because he reminds the rest of the world of what America is, what our mission is, what our raison d'etre is, who we are. You know, again, we are becoming a beacon of freedom and a light unto the nations. You know, that's, if we had done this maybe a little bit more when we had the opportunity after World War II and our glorious victory against the Third Reich and against Imperial Japan, then maybe communism would have collapsed sooner. As it is, Ronald Reagan did it, but it took all the way up until the 1980s to have an American leader articulate the superiority of the American system and contrast that with the inferiority of socialism, whether it be expressed in the form of communism, Nazism, or radical Islam. I want to just point out, speaking of which, before I get back to my article on fake news, I heard a military expert on the air the other day, someone who has done several tours of duty in Iraq and someone who knows the score over there with regard to ISIS and how that war is going. And he reported that the war is going very, very well and that ISIS very likely may be defeated within the next months and that they are on the run, that the city of Raqqa, their capital, is under siege right now as we speak. We don't hear a lot about it because the Trump administration doesn't need to stand up and toot its horn every time there's a success. They're doing it quietly, but they're doing it effectively. And maybe while he talks to Vladimir Putin, there could be some coordination with the Russians. Hopefully will be. But this military expert pointed out that the reason that things are getting more successful is because President Trump has given authority to the military figures on the field and to Secretary of Defense Mattis to do what's necessary to win, to conduct the war, and to take advantage of opportunities when they arise. He gave a specific example of a very successful mission that involved helicopters landing on a certain rooftop and taking a certain building and killing certain terrorists and conducting an incredible, daring, astonishing operation, which was apparently a complete success. And that he pointed out that this same operation could not have happened in the Obama years because Obama did not give that kind of authority to the military leaders in the field. He didn't give that authority even to the Defense Department. He would have to have been informed about it in advance. There would then be meetings, there'd be conferences, there'd be discussions. The thing would drag on for weeks. Eventually, he would usually decide not to do it, or if, you know, by the time he got around to it, it would be too late. It would have lost its effectiveness. And so there was nothing happening. The rules of engagement were nothing but static and stasis. Nothing would be achieved, and so the war dragged on for 3 years. And the result has been upwards of 1 million people killed, millions of people displaced. That's why you have refugees who are now streaming into Europe and the United States, possibly. All of this could have been avoided if Obama had allowed his military to defeat ISIS right away in the field. I mean, does anyone think this country couldn't defeat ISIS quickly, even in a day? It may not be, you know, it may not be pretty, and it may be, you know, tough. But is that better than the way it's been handled, where you have millions of people dead because of this ongoing bleeding, this huge expense, the loss of lives, of American lives, not to mention? So now that Trump is in the White House, and now that we have a sane policy, which is similar, by the way, to the policies of Franklin Roosevelt in World War II, who didn't micromanage things. He let the generals, he let Eisenhower and MacArthur and the other generals decide what to do, and they did. Instead, you know, if we had had Trump in place back then this whole disaster may not be unfolding. Maybe if Mitt Romney had won the election and Obama didn't hold power for that second miserable, putrid term, maybe Romney would have done it. I mean, I think Romney would have done a better job. I don't know how much better, but he did bring up the fact that Obama, during one of his debates, brought up the fact that Obama was planning on evacuating the Green Zone in Baghdad, a disastrous idea. This country spent huge sums of money building this Green Zone. It's a fortified part of Baghdad, walled off, that was a high-tech military base with extraordinary reach, one that could have reached any corner of Iraq in assistance to the government there, to keep, you know, to maintain stability and to keep out the collapse of the country. What, you know, Obama evacuated it, and the power vacuum was left so that ISIS could step in and take over large swaths of Iraq and Syria. And so now we have a mess over there. And Trump is quite right when he says that he's inherited a mess. But he's in Poland, and he is talking about, you know, making America great and all these other wonderful themes, and pointing out that the West will never be broken. And people are applauding, except, of course, the fake media, which continues to goose-step along and insist that we should ignore this stuff and instead go back to the old, decrepit ways of world government and nanny state, I just hope people wake up and realize the extraordinary opportunity we have right now in this country with President Trump. You know, don't listen to, you know, the discredited, disgraced newsman, Brian Williams. I heard him the other day on, I think he's, was it CBS? You know, moaning about how America is, like, in crisis and the milieu they talk about. The milieu with their phony British accents. We're in crisis. Why? Because Trump's president. Yeah, maybe he's in, his group is in crisis. In other words, the left is in crisis. Yes. They're having major crisis. You know, they don't stand for anything. I mean, it's the same old, you know, authoritarian language. And Trump was putting it under siege, mainly through his tweets. Anyways, I love those tweets. And I want to tweet myself more. And I suggest you, my listener, develop your own tweet empire. This is a chance for individuals, at no cost, I may add, to develop their own media empires. I'm doing it. Why shouldn't you? I have, between Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and a couple of other lesser sites, I probably have pretty close to 30,000 followers by now, at least 25,000 followers. And these are people that I've approved. I can send out a tweet. I can send out a notice on my Facebook page. And it's seen by at least a fraction, a percentage of those people. Trump has 30 million followers. He has three times as many followers as all these smart-ass cable stations. And it's driving them nuts. He can speak his mind and do so unvetted and uninterpreted, and they can't stop it. Maybe eventually they'll find a way to stop it. Certainly if Obama was working hard to stop it by turning over the internet to a foreign power, something that I'm going to get into in my next column for Newsmax. Let me just go back to my column here. By exposing that this is my column in Newsmax, by exposing the fake media, President Trump might ultimately force them to become more honest. They are realizing that they no longer hold a monopoly on the media and information highway. Every time President Trump sends out a Twitter storm, which he tends to do in the early morning hours, it is amusing to listen to the so-called experts on stations like MSNBC virtually go nuts with their rage and confusion. We have entered a new media age, and there is no turning back. Now anyone can be heard, and the old guard gatekeepers of information must now compete. Perhaps they might eventually respond to this democratic trend by going back to Journalism 101. By reporting the truth, and by doing the arduous and painstaking work of investigation. After all, how many times can they be expected to be exposed as liars and then expect to go on, business as usual? The new media, which is mostly free and which is available to the average person, has already changed the course of history. Gone are the days when CBS evening news anchor Uncle Walter Cronkite could opine from his high and mighty perch, intoning like he was Moses descending from Sinai. And that's the way it is. Really? Cronkite biographer Douglas Brinkley pretty much let the cat out of the bag in terms of how biased and left-wing old Uncle Walter was. Now the responsibility for investigating corruption has fallen into the hands of figures such as YouTube star James O'Keefe and his Project Veritas. O'Keefe and his team operating undercover, exposed voter fraud in the 2010 election. Let me refresh your memory. Congressman Terry Moran of Virginia, his son, was caught on camera by one of the Operation Veritas undercover guys, instructing, he was instructing her in terms of how to commit voter fraud in Virginia. They caught several other examples of people, you know, engaging in various types of voter fraud. He was fired for that. I think Moran was driven out of office over it. But it's this kind of reporting being done by James O'Keefe that is really the essence of what journalism should be about. He's going in and he is uncovering corruption and crime and contradiction. You know, it was his undercover people that went into Planned Parenthood and discovered this really sinister and murky business of trading in baby body parts. Now, I understand you may support Planned Parenthood, but wouldn't Planned Parenthood be a better organization if this was investigated by Congress? I got an email from Congressman Joe Kennedy telling me, oh, I have to support Planned Parenthood. You know, the right wing is attacking Planned Parenthood. Well, fine. Maybe I would support Planned Parenthood, but only if we can find out what happened with this baby body parts scandal that they've not denied. Let there be a congressional investigation. Let's get to the bottom of it. Prosecute the evildoers. Clean it up, and then maybe they could be supported. But why should they be supported otherwise? Do we want to support a group that's engaging in this or allegedly engaging in this kind of activity? I mean, James O'Keefe's undercover work is very, very difficult to refute because he's using the tools of the new media, mainly YouTube videos. It's very easy to do. You just turn on your smartphone and you've got a video. It's fantastic. Facebook, you could live stream it. I think that also it was James O'Keefe's people who have exposed the perfidy of CNN and their hateful, bogus attitude toward Trump by getting Van Jones, of all people, the former communist, now CNN reporter, saying that the whole Russia-Trump conspiracy was nothing but a, quote, nothing burger, unquote. That's sensational. So James O'Keefe did this by filming examples that could, as such, not be refuted. Two Democratic operatives, Scott Fogel and Robert Kramer, both lost their jobs after a Project Veritas sting that exposed them allegedly trying to create violence that would then fit the media smear against Trump. Now, let me refresh your memory on this, and you can go to YouTube to see this. Scott Fogel and Robert Kramer were hired. In the case of Scott Fogel, it was by the DNC. In the case of Robert Kramer, it was by the Hillary Clinton campaign to engage in dirty tricks at Trump rallies and do other things like that. What they were doing, and it was caught on video by James O'Keefe, was they would go to Trump rallies and they would basically try to create a violent incident. They would, you know, throw a fist at someone, or they would insult someone in the ugliest way, or they would just go there to try to create as much trouble as possible. And then when they would get the reaction, they would then report that, or they would film that themselves and say, you see, look, Donald Trump is violent. He's advocating violence. This is a meme that the left is continuing to push. And he's, you know, creating an atmosphere of violence. This was the narrative. And they would create it. so they could then use it. It's kind of like, not to draw an example here, but in Israel you've got situations where Palestinian Arabs are throwing rocks at Israeli soldiers, and then when the soldiers react, they get that on film and they say, you see, Israel is violent. Israel is oppressive. It fits into a narrative. They instigate, you know, you create the incident and then you use it as propaganda. Anyway, we would only know about this. We only know about this because James O'Keefe's undercover Project Veritas people uncovered it and filmed it. You can't get around it. Back to the article. The old liberal media responds with unprecedented wars against President Donald Trump. A war that goes well beyond the bounds of responsible journalism. A war that nips at the edges of outright sedition. They continue with their phony British accents, talking about the, quote, crisis that, quote, pervades the country, and the unhealthy, quote, milieu that has dominated since the election. They make dark innuendo comparing the president to Hitler, and then they wonder why there has been an increase in violence against Republicans, why there are now cases where a gunman, a known liberal, shoots Republican Representative Steve Scalise at a baseball game. By the way, this same guy, this Tomlinson, who showed up at a Republican baseball practice looking for Republicans with a list of Republicans in his pocket and started shooting at people randomly. He planted a story that was used by Rachel Maddow. He had extensive email exchanges with the office of Senator Dick Durbin. Durbin refuses to release those emails. He was a major Democratic Party operative. Whether he was crazy or not is irrelevant. I mean, who is stoking the atmosphere of hate? Really? The old liberal media has every right to investigate and criticize the president and his administration, but maybe they might consider focusing on the issues. Let them criticize Trump's policies on taxes, immigration, regulations, trade, health care. This probably won't happen anytime soon, as they are no doubt cognizant of the likelihood that they would lose such arguments. Thus, they resort to personal smear and conspiracy theories. And thus, we react by learning the ways and means of the new media to expose what is true and what is false. So anyway, that's my column. It's up on Newsmax. It's up on Blogger. You're welcome to check those out. I also have on those pages a feed of my podcast, which is mostly this show, but it also is other, podcasts I do from home. This isn't the only broadcast I do. I have a live platform online that I can interview anyone I want, or I could just go on and talk if I want, just like I'm doing right now. And, that also goes on my Blogger, and that's up on iTunes and a bunch of other places. Okay, so let's see. I'm at the Drudge Report. Polish crowd chants Donald Trump USA. There's a video here. The Polish crowd attending President Trump's speech in Warsaw repeatedly interrupted his remarks with chants of Donald Trump USA. At a reflang ceremony in Kaczynski Square, the excited crowd broke out into an American-style USA, USA chant. Later, during Trump's prepared remarks, the crowd repeatedly interrupted the speech with a Donald Trump chant. The story of Poland is a story of a people who have never lost hope, who have never been broken, and who have never, ever forgotten who they are, Trump said in Warsaw before the crowd began chanting his name. Thank you so much. Thank you, he replied. Thank you so much. A great honor. Trump's speech celebrated the United States' alliance with Poland and announced the country was purchasing a Patriot air defense missile system that the Obama administration had canceled as part of his revamped START nuclear treaty. I wonder how the left is going to explain this. I thought Trump was supposed to be in the pocket of Putin. I thought Putin elected Trump with their cockamamie conspiracy theory. Think maybe it might have been the other way around? Maybe Putin's stooge would have been Hillary? Maybe that's why Obama said nothing when he knew that the election was being hacked? I don't know. Trump's speech also thanked Poland for being one of the only NATO members to fully honor its financial commitment to the Western Security Alliance. And by the way, Trump's insistence on that is starting to bear fruit. European nations are starting to pay those bills. All right? Other presidents might have made reference to it. Even Obama probably did. Who knows? But everyone knew they didn't mean it. It was just a lot of sophistry. With Trump, they know he means it because Trump says what he means. He speaks basic truths. And so they're responding. They're paying their bills. Back to the speech. That is also why we salute the Polish people for being one of the NATO countries that has actually achieved the benchmark for investment in our common defense. Trump also said the United States remains firmly committed to honoring NATO's Article 5. To those who would criticize our tough stance he's taken with asking NATO members to honor their financial commitments, Trump said, I would point out that the United States has demonstrated not merely with words, but with its actions, that we stand firmly behind Article 5, the mutual defense commitment. So Trump is speaking quite publicly and quite bluntly in Poland, just as he did when he was in Riyadh and called out Islamic terrorism on Islamic soil. I say here, I'm excited. I feel that this is, thank God for Donald Trump. I pray for him every day. I hope you do too. You know, for the sake of the country. And just because we're into a time of real awareness of who we are as Americans, who we are as people. Let's embrace that. Let's cherish it. Let's own it. And let's embody it and move forward. They may take Trump down, and they probably will, given the forces he's up against. But if we can understand the nature of what he's about, then we can continue without him, because he's just one person at bat. Anyways, is Zach here?